You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 512. The theme, what's behind the emotion, the meaning, all that comes later. Stanley Kubrick.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer, director, and actress Carlson Young. Now, Carlson is the director of the new film, The Blazing World, that premiered at Sundance 2021. And I wanted to have her on the show to kind of go down the rabbit hole, literally, because her movie has a bit of that in it, to go down the rabbit hole about what it's like to direct her first feature, getting that great cast, how it got all put together. And after talking to her, the struggle is real. I mean, no matter where you are and who you are, all filmmakers have the same challenges in one degree or another. So it is a fascinating conversation. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Carlson Young. I'd like to welcome to the show Carlson Young. How are you doing, Carlson?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Like we were talking about earlier, before we came on, the first time I remember seeing you is in that amazing Key and Peele short. I want to say your real name, Jacqueline, but it's Jacqueline.
Jacqueline,
which was downloaded like 50 million times. And I mean, as an actress, you want to be seen 50 million times, especially when you're a young actress.
Suppose that's true. Yes.
did you get call out? Like a lot of people are like, oh, Jacqueline.
I really did. I remember like being at a stop sign, like in Franklin Village in LA, Beechwood Canyon, and somebody like screeched the brakes and rolled down the window and was like, Jacqueline. And I thought to myself, if nothing else in my life, I am Jacqueline. So.
Well, you've done other things as well. You've definitely done other things as well. So how did you get into the business?
I had really always wanted to pursue acting and be an actor and director and writer my whole childhood, but my parents didn't really know how to facilitate that for me, which is all well and good because I really am a firm believer that should be your own accord, not a parent's. And I found myself an agent when I was like 14 or 15, did some commercial work. Did a Disney short show my junior and senior year of high school that actually shot in Austin, and then moved to LA and ended up going to USC for English creative writing and doing acting work throughout, you know, my early 20s. And then, the Blazing World is my first, this is the thing that I want to do.
Yeah. I had a pleasure of seeing it, and it is definitely a trippy film without question. It's like you definitely go down the rabbit hole and then some in that film. But before we get to the feature, it started off with a short, right?
That's right. It was a short. It was inspired by recurring dreams that I was having as I was working on another show in Louisiana. And the short is very much a vignette and a sketch of the character's life and just my visual sort of sensibilities as a filmmaker. And I knew that I had to sort of make this seed in order to sell people on me being able to direct the feature.
Yeah, so that was my next question. How did you get people to give you money? How did you get the financing for this? How did you bring this all together? I mean, because it's tough. It's just tough, period.
Oh, God.
It's insane.
It's so hard. we attached our first actor the beginning of March 2020. Mm-hmm. And we were so excited, felt like it was really happening. And then, you know, the pandemic and the world shuts down. So we're like, well, fuck. And so my producer and I just were like, well, I mean, if I rewrote the script in a couple of parts, then maybe we could take this out of public places and have a really contained quarantine environment. So that took a couple months of reworking and truly engineering the entire project around COVID and the restrictions there. And we shot in August 2020, and I swear to God, by the skin of our teeth, it was really hard. But it's not easy.
So you finished August of 2020.
And had our cut submitted to Sundance October 7th.
Oh, my God. That's
exhausted. Are you so tired thinking about that?
I'm exhausted, and it wasn't even my film. I'm exhausted thinking about that process because, well, first of all, shooting in August of 2020, I don't remember. I mean, you think, was there a lull in COVID at that point? There was a lull, right?
There was a lull. It was like the worst was very much yet to come. Right. And it was still, you know, like, okay, there's like 300 cases in Texas, you know. It wasn't anything like the winter, you know. Winter was coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. I wanted to just ask, like, did you approach investors? Did you show the short and go, here's the short, here's the feature script. I want to direct. I've never directed, but here's my short. And they said, okay, obviously.
I mean, it's always the like catch 22, like the first time director's nightmare of like, mm-hmm. I'm a first time director, please. And then, but you know, the short was really good proof of concept. It had been embraced by a good festival. We had an amazing co-writer. We had a great team around the project, and we were like, this is very much something that could be a festival, you know, movie if you want to get on board with sort of the bigger vision of me as a director and this whole team. Then that's kind of how we did it, private equity in Austin.
That's pretty amazing. Now, how did you get your cast? Like, you have a pretty remarkable cast.
It's a great cast. I wrote the Lane Ed role for Udo Kier, who had always been like, he'd always been like a legend. I mean, he is a legend, but he'd always been like a personal, like, I love this man. And mm-hmm. I can't describe it. He feels like my father on like a spiritual level. Doesn't make a ton of sense, but I just love him. And so I wrote the character for him. So when we got him the script, and he wanted to do it, it was just like, okay, wow, we're off to the races. And then Dermot and Vanessa Soko, John Carno, we have a great cast.
Yeah, it was a pretty remarkable cast, to say the least. Now, so you're shooting during COVID, which is shooting your first movie in general is a rough scenario. let alone with the COVID pressures on top of you, which you could, like, am I going to get shut down tomorrow? Am I not going to get shut down tomorrow?
Like, the mortal concern of every person who has been generous enough to give us their time and their best work in this incredibly crazy time just was like, I felt that weight every day. On top of the normal stress of an 18-day shoot, like, it was hard. So I tell everyone, I'm like, if the second one is just 3% less mortal stress, then that will be really, really dope.
That would be amazing. Now, as directors, you know, there's always that one day on set where the world is coming down around you. You literally just say, this is going to, I'm crashing and burning. I'm drowning. The whole world is, this is a disaster. I can't believe I'm here. Who gave me the keys to this car? What day was that for you, and how did you overcome it?
You know, as stressful as the outside environment was, just because of the COVID of it all, the set and the shoot was really zen. Mm-hmm. Like we had so much to do and such an enormous scope of a story to tell that there just really wasn't any room for stress. It was like this weird compartmentalized, because I was also acting. So, I mean, there just like wasn't room to like short circuit. Like there was no capacity for it.
Right.
So, you know, it was really hard. I mean, like, for just personal things were happening for me. Like, it was very much like art imitating life, imitating art, imitating life. There was things where my sister got married. I wasn't able to be there. There was all sorts of things going on. We were in a proper quarantine camp. So it was a surprisingly zen shoot itself. But the whole world was trying to like get in my head, and I had to keep it out.
So it's tough enough to direct. It's tough enough to direct during a COVID pandemic, but then you also acted in it. How do you balance? Like, I've acted once or twice in something I've shot, and I was, oh God, it was horrible because I'm not an actor. But how was it? But how did you balance that, especially in your first time out as a director?
Well, I had had a little taste of it from the short, and just from the short, I knew that I could do it. I knew that it was something that I had bandwidth to do. And I, you know, I was fortunate enough to have an incredible assistant who was really keeping me honest as to the character and where we were. I sort of had like this big energy map that I was mapping everything off of, in terms of moments and story and tone. And I just didn't question it. I just didn't give myself any room to question it. I have experience as an actor, and I'm not camera shy at all. So it's just like, you know, it's a great thing being a director and an actor, because I know exactly what I'm looking for. And then I can give that to myself, which is kind of a rewarding thing.
Now, you mentioned energy mapping. Can you kind of dig into that? I've never actually heard that term before. So what is an energy map in your world, and what how did you use it?
I think, well, whenever I watch a film, like the thing that really pops out and resonates with me the most is the tone. And that's, in my mind, tone is kind of synonymous with energy, because it's like the air that the characters are breathing and that the score is on. And it's like, you know, dropping a needle on a record. It's like a very particular vibration, which all sounds a bit like abstract, but mm-hmm. In this story in particular, she goes under the water. She's in the bathtub. So when she goes under the water, I sort of tonally did the rest of the story like she's losing oxygen in her brain. And so there's different like grace periods that her brain is going for. and then it drops, and then yeah, so like the tone becomes more frenetic and more sort of manic as it goes.
And you were using that as a kind of guideposts in the sand, if you will, as you're going through this process, because you're without, so you're basically lost at sea almost.
Yeah, you're lost at sea, and then, you know, I mean, you can get an amazing performance out of an actor, where I could give a good performance or something, but it might not be right in terms of where we are in the story and the energy. So it's really easy to watch something and be really blown away by it, but it might not be able to fit into this thing. So yeah.
And how do you judge your own performance? I mean, that must be brutal. Like, did I get it? Did I not get what I wanted as a director?
I don't know. I'm excited to, like, for the next couple, like, not act in it. Mm-hmm. And I think that will be a really nice distance. But for this one, I mean, my editor and, like, everyone on the team would always kind of chuckle, because I would never refer to myself as the character. It would be, you know, it was her, Margaret, what is she doing? It was never me looking at myself. Like, I'm looking at the character. And, like, our editor thought that was kind of jarring at first, because he'd be like, we're looking at, like, you on the screen, but you're, like, referring to this, like, other person. And so that's how I can gauge the performance. So I'm not looking at myself. I'm looking at an actor performing a thing.
It's a way for you to disconnect.
Yeah, totally disassociate.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's a completely just disconnect from what's going on. And because as an editor, you're looking at things like, even, again, the small times that I've directed myself in a scene, I just was like, who's that guy? Oh, God, Jesus. Oh, he's horrible. Oh, this is that. Like, I become, my director hat comes on, and I'm like, I start beating up myself as the actor. It must be tough. But yeah. you not so much with you.
Yeah. I sort of like have a level of like respect for myself as an actor, and so and all the other actors, which is bizarre, because usually I'm like a total masochist who has like no respect for myself. So. So that's like an interesting grace that I have apparently for myself. I don't know.
So as an actress, you know, you've worked with a lot of directors in your career. How do you like to be directed? I always loved asking actors that, like, because every actor is a little bit different in regards to how they like to be directed.
I love to have, if it's possible, to have the opportunity to get inside the director's previous work and to also get inside their head as to what they're thinking for this particular project. Not always you have, I mean, you don't always have that luxury as an actor. Sometimes you just show up and you're just saying the lines and going home, you know, which is so much of the case of TV, which is what I definitely have done the most of. But film is this thing where you get to have a language with the creative team and get to hear everybody's perspective on the character and then give your interpretation of it. And that's what I really like about acting.
Now, what do you look for in a director as far as someone who's going to direct you? What are the qualities? What are the techniques that you're looking for? Because, I mean, we've all heard the stories of the crazy director on set who's abusive or yelling, and you didn't get the, you know, there's just so many different, you know, images of directors over the years, from the monocle to the blowhorn back in the silent days to someone to someone like Clint Eastwood, who just goes, that was good, let's move on, and that was, and he says four words to you.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had the luxury of working with, I worked with a lot of directors, but I have never worked with like a real auteur before. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I've noticed about directors I really liked working with is they're calm and decisive, and they have good taste and they know what they're doing. And I think as a director, the most important thing is making choices and knowing how to steer the ship, and then everybody else trusting you in that. So the worst thing is like if a director like doesn't know you know, like
that. I don't know. Maybe. What do you think? Yeah. Like, there is the what do you think, because it's a collaboration. But when you feel like they don't know where the ship is going,
yeah.
The whole thing's going to crash.
Yeah. That's a little concerning.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So, and I've always told this to young directors, you know, when you're working with actors, actors want to feel secure. They want to feel safe and they want to be able to have a safe space to perform and to be, I mean, what actors do, what you guys do is remarkable because you're exposed emotionally. We're asking you to go, you know, that really difficult, horrible thing I'm never going to experience. I want you to do that for me for my pleasure, please. And action. Like it's tough. It's an insanity, really.
It is. It's a form of insanity. No doubt. No doubt about it.
So
I mean, you get every now and then you get an actor who, and with Blazing World, this was very much the case, where they have a personal investment in the character and the project succeeding. Everybody was so generous with their time and their energy for these characters. Like, everybody had an entry point into the material from a really beautiful, profound place. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a luxury to sit back with the director and watch them work. The on-ramp was respect. They respected the story. And so I was able to create a safe space for them as actors.
And is that how you approach pulling performances out of your actors, or coaching, like not coaching, but guiding them to the performance that you're looking for? How do you approach it as a director?
Well, you know, for this one, we didn't have rehearsal time or anything like this. So for me, it was setting the stage of, number one, thank you so much for being here. I deeply am a big fan of your work and I respect you so much as an actor. Here's what I'm thinking, and here's all of the backstory and the good nitty gritty details that I can give you as a director for what I'm thinking. And then those tools are yours to use at your leisure, you know, here's your tool belt and feel free to put it on for this scene and like, let's see what happens. And, yeah, and so it was beautiful. I loved working with this team.
Yeah, the team and the cast. I mean, the cast must have been wonderful. And you had, I mean, how did you deal with all the? I mean, you have a fairly good amount of visual effects in this film, and for someone who's never directed a feature film, let alone dealing with visual effects, because I've been a VFX supervisor, I understand the complexity of that. How did you deal with that?
It was a challenge. I mean, there was a time where I wanted to do like all of that, practically everything. Ridiculous. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. Right. We had a limited crew size, because of the pandemic and, not very many days at all. So we couldn't do any of those things. So the best we could hope for was a locked shot and then a VFX supervisor on set. That is what we must have.
Not so much with not so much with the moving shots on the VFX shots is what you're saying.
Oh God, I'd get in trouble if it was. Yeah.
There was someone yelling at you on set.
You really expensive moving ones, yes.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you want us to track that? That's going to cost another $50,000.
Oh God, I have learned so much. I cannot even tell you.
I could imagine. Look, first, when I first started directing, lock off shots, best VFX shots, lock off shots. Yeah. Don't move the camera.
Lock that shot.
Lock it. Don't move the frame. And then you, as you develop a little bit more, then you feel like, oh, I can move the camera. And okay, I got to get the tracking shots in and I got to do this, and this. And technology's come a long way and all this kind of stuff. But, oh God. You could get into some deep trouble very quickly.
Oh, and talk about zero time to do it. I think our last VFX shot was delivered January 20th, and our premiere was January 29th, and Sundance just like screaming at us, like, you have to get this in. And we're like, please, there's one more shot. And then the cut that actually premiered, like, on the digital platform at Sundance wasn't even the final VFX shots.
Of course.
So I remember people being like, oh, like the worst or something. And I mean, like, it's not our final. Shut the fuck up.
It's so easy to criticize the gladiator in the arena, but they don't get in sometimes.
Tell me about it.
It's so easy to sit in the audience and just go, look at that gladiator. Look what they're doing. Oh, I could do it better.
I know.
So then you submit to Sundance, which is obviously the dream of every independent filmmaker to get into Sundance, especially your first feature. So, you know, it's a shot in the dark. You roll the dice and you throw it in there and you see what happens. And you know the odds are obscene to get into. I mean, I think last year was like 30,000 submissions or something like that, and there's like 110 films accepted or something. So what was it like when you got the call?
Oh, it was so cathartic. It was so beautiful. I just remember like dropping to my knees, like I'm so tired. I'm so tired. I just want to go to sleep. I think I like fell asleep. I just was like, good night. Thank you. But it was just so rewarding because I mean, this is truly what happened. We finished the final score, like that. Literally, it was like the last note. The thing was mixed, and my husband shut his laptop. Okay, like we're done. Oh, you want to like go get some dinner or something to celebrate? And then literally, my cell phone rang, and I was just like, it was too good to be true. It sounds fake, but that is 100% what happened.
That's insane. But I have to ask you, because I love asking artists this. Why do this? This is insanity. It is the most difficult things we could do. It tortures us. It beats us up. We get disappointed. But, you know, it's so, I mean, exhausting is the word I like to use. Exhausting, brutal. And yet, it's like we keep coming back for more. What is it about what we do that is this kind of, I call it kind of a beautiful disease, because once you get bitten by the bug, you're done for life. Yeah. You can't go back ever.
It's true. I think that it's the storytelling component of what we do and the heart of truly profound and moving stories, no matter like what your taste is, no matter if you like horror, thriller, quiet indies, like Marvel movies, whatever it is, whatever stories speak to you, it's incredible the amount of like just darkness that you can sort of power through and put up with if that's what you're in service of. So like I think like people really suffer in this industry because you know what it's like to have that moment of like, oh, like we just did something really cool in this like nanosecond of geological time that we live in. You know, there's something like everybody who is in love with film or great television even knows what it's like to be truly moved into empathy and compassion by characters and an amazing story. And that's just something that that's a depth that requires a lot of sacrifice. And I don't know. I mean, like, it's gotta be why we fucking do it. Like, I don't know.
and as a director, I mean, at least you're an actor. So you get to work all the time as an actor. You can do shows, you can do movies, and you get to perform your art. But as a director, you're lucky once a year. If that's like best case scenario,
it's best case.
That's like once, maybe every 2 or 3 years. It takes you years to get a project off the ground. If you're writing it, getting it off the ground, packaging it, and then you get to shoot for 18 days.
Oh yeah.
And that's the only time you get to actually be what you want to be. And then there's obviously the pre-production part of it and the post-production part of it. But generally, we don't get to direct as much as we want to.
Yeah. Well, something interesting that I think I found throughout the Blazing World process, because it was a long one, it was a long process. 2017 was the short.
Oh, jeez.
2020 was the feature. But what was so interesting was that the, you know, challenges and the slow sort of growth process of every, you know, making a film, like checking all of the boxes, and each time you check a box, it's extremely slow. It's painfully slow, and you have to climb the stairs extremely meticulously and so patiently, and one thing goes right, two things go wrong every time. And so, interestingly enough, in that incredibly challenging process that required a lot of resilience, I learned something about myself and the character and all of these characters and the whole story that I was trying to tell. And that just feels like, I look back and I'm like, I don't think I would do a single thing differently because of that, because that was just so beautiful. And I think that's something probably a lot of people could, you know, I certainly could have benefited from hearing that. I know that people do say that, and it's easier to hear than to put it into practice, but it's pretty cool, like, looking back on all of the just gut-wrenching no's and the things that didn't go right, and being able to see how they were so very in service to a lesson that was being learned or something.
How did you deal with the no's? Because you must have gotten a ton of them prior to actually getting on the set.
So many. So many. But I was used to it as an actor. Like, all right. I hear is no. Like, literally all day, every day, no, 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 no. It's like 500 no's and one yes. Like, that's my life. So I was pretty used to it, although this was a different thing. Like, this was like my heart and soul. Now I'm not just playing somebody else's character. Like, this is a totally different thing. So admittedly, the no's hurt a lot worse than an acting no. Mm-hmm. But I do think that like, just habitual rejection as an actor was a nice prep for the whole process.
Yeah, I can't even understand how you guys do what you do. I mean, every time I do a casting, I'm always very gentle with the actors. And I was like, I try to be as nice and pleasant as possible. But it's right. You get 40 no's a day.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's insane. What made this story, like, obviously this is a personal story to you, it's coming off of your dreams, you were saying. What made you say, because we all have dreams, and many of us have recurring dreams. What made you say, I got to get this out into the world? I need to let this thing loose.
Group therapy. group therapy. I mean, I knew that, you know, I the Blazing World title comes from a 17th century writer, Margaret Cavendish. And she was so bold in 1666 to write a complete, like, fantastical component to her husband's scientific journal, where she was dreaming up this sun world and all of these magical creatures. And I love fantasy and just fantasy mythology so much. It's how I make sense of the world, and it's the stories that I personally really love. And so I always knew that I wanted to make films that were magical and had a fantasy component to them. And I love horror, so some of that sprinkled in there too. But this story was, the more that I chipped away at how to claim power as a female in the way that Margaret Cavendish did in 1666 with her Blazing World, mm-hmm. I realized that in order to step into this, like, empress, this queen, this female empowerment, that you have to clear out so much trauma. And the black hole started becoming for me this, like, dissociative gap in my psyche of things from my childhood that I hadn't processed yet, that was just literal grief, just like sitting in my soul. Mm. And through group therapy and really amazing friendships and connection with people who were also being honest about their vulnerability, I realized that this was actually an incredible universal story, and that when people put it all out there, and like, that is an opportunity for healing for other people too. So it was connecting my story to the story, the big story, and then realizing, oh, like, this could be a fantastical fucking ride where we could actually get somewhere. And, you know, at the end, you know, it's a story about reframing trauma. She makes a tiny little decision differently. She's kind to her parents. She includes them and reframes this memory of trauma. And I think that's a beautiful thing to witness. And I witnessed it with other people. And I just was like, that was when I found the confidence to tell the story.
That's awesome. That's very awesome. Now, when you got the call for Sundance. Now, have you been to Sundance before? Have you been to Park City before that?
I did. I went in 2018 for the short, and that was really, you know, rad because I got to be there in person. So it was so cool, like, to be at Sundance, like, as a filmmaker, even if it was a short. That was the coolest thing of my life. So I can't even imagine what it would have been like to be there in 2020 in person. Maybe the next one.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because it was 20. Yeah. Of course, it was 2020, so that you couldn't go to in person. But with the short, at least you got to go and be a filmmaker and enjoy that process, because it's an interesting. I've been there as just someone who's been there, and I've had films there as well that I've worked on, and it's just a completely different experience. Yeah. When you're screening something that you've been or you worked on.
I like have a smile thinking about how great that would have been. But yeah, we were just on the couch and thanking our lucky stars.
Yes, exactly. Now, where can people see the film?
It's limited theatrical. So anywhere you can find a theater, go check it out, because it's very, very much meant to be seen in a theater. I saw it for the first time in a theater last week, and I was just like, oh, mm-hmm. I wish that people could see it like this, but alas, it is VOD and streaming on Amazon and Apple, and yeah, go rent it or buy it. That would be extremely helpful.
Yes. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oof, that no is not a statement about my worth as a human being.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Absolutely. And that definitely makes sense coming from an actor.
Yes. Yes. Throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Now, three of your favorite films of all time.
Possession. Solaris. And Scenes from a Marriage.
Very good. And what was the biggest fear you had to overcome when putting this entire project together, putting the script, writing the script, attaching yourself as a director, all that? What was the biggest fear you had to overcome, and how did you do it?
The biggest fear that I had to overcome was that I am invalid as an artist, and that yeah. Nobody will care what I have to say.
And you had to break through that.
Had to break through that, yeah.
And last question, what did you learn from your biggest failure, either professionally or in life somewhere that it was a big failure? What was the biggest lesson you learned from that failure?
That failure is an opportunity for growth. In fact, we pretty much only grow in discomfort and uncertainty. So as challenging as those times are, they're sacred. They're sacred times.
And I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It was a pleasure talking to you. I tell everybody to go see The Blazing World. It was a lot of fun. It's definitely a trip down the rabbit hole, to say the least. So Carlson, thank you so much. And continued success, my dear.
Thank you. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
I want to thank Carlson so much for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Carlson. And if you want links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/512. And there you will find a link to her new movie, The Blazing World. And thank you for all the tribe members that I met at the Austin Film Festival this last weekend. It was my first time at the festival. I loved it. It was a great festival. And I look forward to going back many, many more years since I am now stationed here in Austin. So thank you so much for all you tribe members that said all those kind words to me out there. I truly, truly appreciate it. And talking to many of the tribe members at the Austin Film Festival, I realized that many of you just listen to either Indie Film Hustle or Bulletproof Screenwriting and don't even know that I have the other podcast. So apparently I haven't been doing a good enough job cross-promoting. So I'm going to do that now. If you are listening on Indie Film Hustle, which you are right now, I also have an amazing other podcast called Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, where I interview the top storytellers, script doctors, screenwriters, industry agents, managers, all dealing in the screenwriting space. And you can head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv or just search it on your podcast app and find it as well. So, and just spread the word about all the podcasts we do. So I want to get that information out to as many people as humanly possible. Thank you again so much. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, we have an amazing special guest on Thursday. I've been teasing it, but I will now let you know who it is. It is the legendary Edgar Wright, the man behind Baby Driver, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, and Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So many classic films, and Edgar and I have a fantastic conversation. So definitely tune in on Thursday for that. Thank you once again for listening. And as always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.